So good afternoon and welcome to the 496th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. The forum has been meeting monthly since 1983 to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. Today we're pleased to have Mr. Daniel Poneman speaking on prospects for further nuclear weapons proliferation. Daniel B. Poneman is a distinguished fellow of the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center and Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. His work is focused on nuclear security issues. From 2015 through 2023, Mr. Poneman served as President and Chief Executive Officer of Centrus Energy Corporation of Bethesda, Maryland, which supplies nuclear fuel and services for the nuclear power industry. Prior to joining Centrus, from 2009 to 2014, he served as the U.S. Deputy Secretary of Energy and as Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Energy. In the spring of 2013, he served as Acting Secretary for that department. Before serving in the Department of Energy, Mr. Poneman served as a principal of the Scowcroft Group for 8 years. Earlier in his career, Mr. Poneman was a White House Fellow at the Department of Energy, the Director of Defense Policy and Arms Control on the National Security Council staff, and as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Nonproliferation and Export Controls at the National Security Council. Between tours of government service, he practiced law in Washington, D.C. Mr. Poneman has published widely on national security issues. He's the author of 4 books, including his most recent book, Double Jeopardy, Combating Nuclear Terror and Climate Change. Mr. Poneman received an AB and Juris Doctor degrees with honors from Harvard University and a Master of Letters degree in politics from Oxford University. Dan, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you. Thank you, George, for that overly inclusive introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here, and let me thank the warm community welcome on behalf of my wife, Susie, and myself. It feels like we've been here a long time, and it's a wonderful community, and I'm going to come back to the community at the end of these remarks, and it's very helpful that you have a little clock there, so I don't need this. I believe that this is the most dangerous moment that we have faced since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And to put it in some context, and I was discussing this, and by the way, I want to thank George and Karen Look for not only their hospitality, but the reason I'm here is because we were colleagues, and each of them, in their own ways, have made singular contributions to U.S. national security. So I think we should give them a round of applause. What do you think? So last night we were chatting about one of the great thinkers in this field, Graham Allison, longtime dean of the Kennedy School of Government, and also the author of Essence of Decision, which many consider the definitive study of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Graham has been in a number of settings over the last year or so, starting his talks by saying 80, 89, please respond. And I will not drag it out of you like in a platonic dialogue, but it's this. 80 years after the only military use of nuclear weapons at Hiroshima and no further use of nuclear weapons, if you had said to people in 1945, this will not happen for the next 80 years, they would say you're crazy. 80 years also, the second 80, of no superpower conflict. Remember, we had it, World War I, World War II. There's been plenty of conflict, clearly, we know that. But the kind of conflict that might engender a superpower nuclear exchange has not occurred. 9, there's only 9 nuclear weapon states. in 1963, and you can find this easily, it's on YouTube, President Kennedy said he saw an era in the 1970s of 20 or 25 nuclear weapon states, and he considered that the gravest possible risk. And here we are all these years later. Remember, the technology to build nuclear weapons was developed on a slide rule, right? Glenn Miller was popular at that time. So it's not technology limitations. It's not because of technology limitations that Germany and Sweden and others don't have it. We'll come back to that. But why is it? It's because actually we had something that we still, I think, sorely need in this country. We had leadership. On December 8th, 1953, President Dwight David Eisenhower delivered a speech. He had intended to deliver this speech much earlier, but Joseph Stalin, it was going to be his first major speech of his administration, but Joseph Stalin died in March, and they needed some time to assimilate what was going on. So it turned out it was at the UN, and the speech was named Atoms for Peace. And basically, Eisenhower proposed that an international organization, 1957, was formed in the form of the International Atomic Energy Agency, should make sure that nuclear energy could be used for peaceful purposes, not just energy, but also agriculture. You can keep crops from rotting in the fields and so forth, medical radioisotopes, and that there would also be a constraint against the use of nuclear weapons. That was kind of the quid pro quo. That was later codified in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty of 1968, which entered into force in 1970. So because which has now got 191 parties, it's one of the most, it's certainly the most widely subscribed arms control treaty ever, and one of the most subscribed international agreements in the history of the world. So we've been very successful, but I'm saying here today that all of that now stands at risk. And just think about it. I want to take this in tranches. I think we can talk about the superpower competition, we can talk about non-proliferation, and we can talk about a changing conception of what we used to call, or still call, the nuclear triad. For those of you sort of in the arms control world, the first piece is called vertical proliferation, with big powers getting more weapons, and non-proliferation is horizontal, which is more countries getting weapons. So, and again, George and Karen like literally wrote the book on much of what we're about to say here. Recently, the New START Treaty exited this world, shuffled off this mortal coil, and we are now without any arms control among the major nuclear weapon states for the first time since 1972. Unconstrained, in an extraordinarily hostile moment. Even when we had 25,000 nuclear weapons in each arsenal pointing at each other, we got along better than we're getting along now. We at least had arms control. And now we don't even have that kind of communication. And we have a leader in the form of Vladimir Putin, in whom I do not repose great confidence in his judgment, wisdom, or restraint when it comes to anything, including nuclear weapons. That's Russia. For many, many years, China had a pretty de minimis sort of tear off an arm strategy of enough nuclear weapons to make you pay attention and know that you couldn't attack them with impunity. Well, as with many other things in China, they've now got up, this arms control treaty that expired allowed Russia and the United States each 1,550 warheads. China has just hit 500. They're going to hit 1,000 by 2030, probably 1,500 by 2035. So now we're going to have three basically equal nuclear powers, and this creates what I think Isaac Newton called a three-body problem. So however complicated deterrence is among two, think about it in terms of three, and think about even the math of what is your force posture when you have to contemplate the possibility, and it's not impossible to conceive that Russia and China could all end up on the other side. So that's another complication and another risk factor. So we're facing in the vertical proliferation, superpower, a extraordinarily dangerous moment. And it's not hard to imagine. I mean, Putin has already been swaggering around, threatening the possibility of using tactical nuclear weapons if things go badly in Ukraine. And for anybody who's, I don't know if anyone picks up a newspaper, anyone who's looked at the news lately, it's not going well. And Ukraine has shown extraordinary resourcefulness and effectiveness. You know, Putin is very proud of these conferences he holds in St. Petersburg, and the invited guests, of whom there are fewer than there used to be, were welcomed by the sight of billows of smoke, because the drones that the Ukrainians have now deployed are now reaching deeper and deeper into Russian territory, airfields, oil refineries, and so forth. So that's all on the vertical axis. What about nuclear proliferation, where I spent many, many years working? So on the horizontal side, again, we had an extraordinary record of achievement, and not only what I just said in terms of the mere number at staying less than 10, but we had rollback. We got Gaddafi, it's hard to imagine anymore, he gave up his nuclear weapons. We sort of forced them out of Saddam Hussein, and we're crawling all over Iraq with IAEA inspectors, got him out of there. De Klerk in South Africa gave up his nuclear weapons, frankly, because I don't think he wanted the ANC to get a hold of them. But that went backwards. Even major countries, people are surprised to think back. It took a long time to get South Korea to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and actually two of the nuclear weapon states, you know, France and China were latecomers. So we got a lot of progress in recent years, but now think about the current strategic context. What is the message to countries now thinking about nuclear weapons? What happened to Gaddafi? He was literally torn to shreds in the streets. What happened to Saddam Hussein? He ended up at the end of a noose. What happened to Ukraine when they gave up 1,900 nuclear weapons? And all of us were in government during those times, and in reposing confidence in the 19, and Steve Pfeiffer will talk about this eloquently when he comes, he's terrific. But in 1994, on the strength of promises from Russia and the United States and others, security assurances that their territory would be respected, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. Zelensky has called this a horrible mistake. What is the message of that? So between Ukraine, Libya, and Iraq, the overall premise of countries, the 191 who signed up for the Non-Proliferation Treaty, is we think we're going to be safer without nuclear weapons because of this treaty and because we're protected by other deterrents, like the U.S. deterrent, which I'll come back to in a second. That whole calculation has now fundamentally altered. And so if you go to Korea, the polling has now risen from 70 to 76% of the South Korean population saying that they would favor the acquisition of nuclear weapons. Think about their situation and the message there. Guess who hasn't been attacked? Guess who didn't end up torn up in the streets? Kim Jong-un. He got nuclear weapons and he got immunity, because who's going to attack a country that's actually got nuclear weapons? Especially a country run by an individual like that. So the message is, if you're North Korea and if you cross the Rubicon and you put a seismic signal that others can detect, you have just inoculated yourself in many ways from the kind of attack that has now basically clobbered Ukraine. So the incentive structure has fundamentally altered in a bad way. And I think the most effective, I'd almost call it secret weapon, that has prevented more proliferation is what we call the U.S. nuclear umbrella, or the, to use the term of art, extended deterrent. Japan, Korea, Australia, NATO members, all are beneficiaries of security guarantees, not assurances like the Budapest Memorandum, which is not binding legally, but guarantees of U.S. protection against adversaries. You know, the one country, this is kind of an abstruse question, the one country that we worried about last among the European countries in terms of its own nuclear weapons ambitions, Sweden. Guess where Sweden isn't? NATO, right? So Japan, Germany, all of these countries, they could have nuclear weapons in short order, but they repose greater confidence in being protected by the U.S. extended deterrent. Well, without getting into gory detail, let's just say, you know, when one country threatens to attack another country inside an alliance, that's not a reassuring signal. And people are, it's just a fact, reassessing. So now who's talking about nuclear weapons? I mentioned the Vox Populi in Korea is concerning, right? The new president, Lee Jae-myung, has calmed the waters, but it tells you what's roiling around in the body politic. And Japan has a obvious, you know, historic, deep antipathy to nuclear weapons. Even there's a conversation now. They had a thing called the three no's. They would not produce, possess, or permit nuclear weapons. And there's now at least a conversation about what about permitting? I don't mean to be alarmist. I'm just trying to be realistic. Poland, the Prime Minister of Poland, is now talking about whether they'd be safer with nuclear weapons. Not surprising given where they are situated in Europe vis-a-vis Ukraine. So that's the second whole, I would call, fraying of the nonproliferation regime. The third piece, and there's various ways of defining this. I'm going to give this my own definition. There is a traditional triad, which is our long-range bombers, our intercontinental ballistic missiles, and our submarine launch missiles. But now I think we have sort of, and there's various ways to define, I'm going to give it my own definition. There's a new triad. What I just said, I would call the nuclear triad. Then we have a whole new generation of advanced conventional weapons, these so-called hypersonics, traveling at Mach 5 at depressed trajectories. The ones the U.S. are developing will have conventional warheads. China and Russia might have nuclear warheads. So this is a whole new terrain of risk, very hard to defend against. And then the third leg of this new triad are new domains, like outer space. There was an outer space treaty from 1967. You're not supposed to put nuclear weapons in space. Not clear Russia's adhering to that. They lofted a satellite. There's a lot of commentary. George and Karen probably know more about it than anybody. And the idea is they might actually set off a nuclear weapon in space, not killing other satellites kinetically, but putting out an electromagnetic pulse that would like fry thousands of satellites. It could have a devastating impact. Chinese are developing these kinds of weapons as well. And then there's cyberspace. You know, we have, I don't know, 12 or 14, I used to know by heart, critical infrastructures, but like underlying all of them is electricity. And just imagine if China is inside our systems and could take down our grid. There go your hospitals, there go your transportation, there goes your financial transactions. So that's why I'm saying it's just a much, much more dangerous world. And what's worse is I think the danger are only increasing. And if not reversed, I think could lead to a genuine global catastrophe. So as Lenin used to say, what is to be done? Most of you have probably heard about the theory of holes, which is when you're at the bottom of a deep hole, the first thing to do is stop digging. Many of these holes are outside of our control. What other countries are doing, they're doing, and we can't basically coerce. We'd like to, but we've not been successful at coercing North Korea and others to do it. It was easier to coerce them when Russia and China were on our side. They used to at least be nominally on our side in nonproliferation negotiations. That's no longer the case. One place where we can stop digging, and I'm going to make three suggestions. I don't want to go on too long so we can have time for a question. I'm going to make three recommendations. One, and this might strike some of you as counterintuitive, I think we need to bolster the U.S. deterrent. And this has two important components. One is a physical component, because we have aging systems, so the Minuteman ICBM is being replaced by the Sentinel. We have the Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines being replaced by the Columbia-class submarines, and we have a new version of an extraordinarily effective bomber, the B-21, the Raider, which apparently, according to what I've read in the press, if the radar signature of a B-2 is the size of a bird, this radar signature is the size of a mosquito, right? The department I used to lead, Department of Energy, is very strained now. They are supposed to make 80 pits of nuclear weapons a year. They're having a hard time getting there. But I think we need to, because of the importance of the extended deterrent, I think we need to go through and make that modernization effective and successful. But the deterrent is only good as the declaratory policy and the credibility thereof. And I think the other part of the extended deterrent is we need to wash away the anxieties that our treaty allies have now begun to feel because of all the things you read in the press that I don't need to repeat to this audience. And so I think we need to be very clear about our intention to honor our security commitments to our treaty allies. So that's recommendation number one. Recommendation number two, I think we need to revitalize nuclear diplomacy. As I said, even at a time when we pointed literally tens of thousands, many more than we have today, weapons at one another, at each other's cities, we managed to find ways to communicate, both in terms of providing crisis stability and in terms of actually meaningful reductions. Every president, Nixon had SALT, Ford had Vladivostok, it went on and on, and Obama had the last one with New START. And it's hard to do this without what the French call an interlocuteur valable, and we don't. But that does not mean we should not be ready. And I actually participated in a task force that was co-chaired by the Nuclear Threat Initiative and Ernie Moniz and the Carnegie Endowment and the Belfer Center at Harvard that said even in this time of turmoil, we need to be open to the possibility of nuclear diplomacy. And related to that, recommendation number two is recommendation number three, which is we need new approaches to new problems, specifically the cyberspace and outer space conundrum. And we haven't talked about it yet, but it's obviously very important, artificial intelligence. Like many quantum leaps in technology, AI could have profound impacts, but both on the offense and the defense. On the offense, if you are trying to protect the United States, say, with a golden dome, missile defense, which we are attempting to do, imagine how much harder that job becomes when AI on the offense is spoofing you into thinking that this is a missile, but it's really a piece of tinfoil. And so AI makes that much more complicated. On the other hand, if George and Karen's successors in the arms control community are able to leverage AI for detection, surveillance, and verification, it can be a good thing. We haven't, I don't think, sorted through all that, but I think that we need to. So these are three sort of pragmatic recommendations, but I think the overarching principle of recommendation, the thing that is most precious and sometimes in shortest supply, is wisdom and leadership. And I said I would come back to Maine, and this is where I'm coming back to Maine. as George indicated in his introduction, I had the privilege and honor of working for and with General Brent Scowcroft, you know, for many, many, many years. And I think it's widely considered that the National Security Council process that he led under President Bush 41 and other Maynard was the best we ever had. And I remember I was there at the NSC in September of 1991 when General Scowcroft went out fishing, I think it was in Maine, with President Bush 41, and they came up with a major initiative. We then at that time removed the tactical nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula and so forth. There was vision. There was leadership. And when you ask President Bush 41, who I also had the real honor to work with more in his later years, why General Scowcroft was such an effective national security advisor, he said, because he tells me what I need to know, not what I want to hear. We need more of that. And when you ask President Bush, how did you make such good decisions? He said, well, experience. And when you said, well, how do you get experience? He said, by making bad decisions. So I think the ethos and, frankly, the patriotism and the, it's not just wisdom, it's the intellectual heft leveraged by that wisdom. And the last thing I'm going to say about Maine is not about any personality. Maine has the additional virtue of not being Washington, D.C. And so many, I don't mean to be anti-jingoistic or whatever, but so often we repose our responsibilities in sort of, I'm not going to say deep state, but conventional thinking from traditional elites. And I think one of the things we need to do as a country is to have more engagement across more communities. And when you say in a practical way, how do we really become more wise as a country? I think it's from conversations in places like this with people like you and having people like them, I can't say us anymore because I left government a long time ago, hear common sense views from Americans who are as patriotic and as empowered and have as much agency as anyone ought to in the country. Because otherwise, to go back to my first point, we are in big trouble. So I want to thank you all for hosting me and Susie here on this wonderful, delightful day here in Maine. And I hope that through conversations like this, that even though I might have painted a dark and threatening picture of what we're about to face, you know, the first step towards any solution is recognizing the scope and the nature of the problem. Hopefully we've done a little bit in that direction, and I'm looking forward to questions to learn more from your side. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. It's always nice when the speaker doesn't end simply on a negative, but rather that's because there's not much positive going on around us. While they collect questions from our members here, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question myself.
Yep.
I have several of them, but the one that at least my interests me most, you mentioned that Russia was threatening tactical nuclear weapons, smaller nuclear weapons, shorter range nuclear weapons use in Ukraine. The U.S. got rid of all of its shorter range weapons a long time ago. We are tactical nukes. And I was just wondering what impact you thought. We used to have a strategy of controlled escalation and all. What effect now, if Russia were to use tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, what do we do? I mean, are we can't do something comparable with them.
Well, I think one thing that the recent actions in Iran have indicated is that you can do extraordinary damage without nuclear weapons. The ability of, for example, Israeli intelligence to so thoroughly penetrate the Iran system that they take out not only facilities but key scientists. And I don't think you can ever bomb the brains out of a nuclear weapons program, but what we have said, and you know this, George, is that we are able to deliver devastating damage where we need to without using nuclear weapons. I think given the fact that you say, as we've gotten rid of our own tactical nukes, I think that's where we're going to have to repose our confidence. And in the case, for example, when they took out Haniyeh, the Hamas leader, when he was in a guest house in Tehran, and they got him in this room and he didn't get the kids in the other room, shows how penetrated some of these systems are. And I think we're going to have to rely on other kinds of mechanisms to get that kind of job done if it comes to that.
There's a question that would go back basically to the question I asked to begin with, and that is, what has deterred Putin so far from using nuclear weapons in Ukraine? What is the deterrence in this aspect?
I'll tell you what it's not. It's not moral scruple, okay? That's what it's not. I think it's fear. I think it's uncertainty. I think, I'm not a shrink, but I think the famous line imputed to Louis XIV, l'état c'est moi, I am the state, I think that's generally speaking his view. And I think if he felt he was going to fail in achieving his messianic ambition, I do not think he would hesitate. And I think it's probably the uncertainty of something more dreadful than he could inflict on Ukraine. And that's why, frankly, I never like it, and this has happened many times, when the U.S. takes threats off the table. I don't like it when we take threats off the table. I want him to have that anxiety, because I think that anxiety, not any moral compass, is the only thing keeping us from a catastrophic event.
So here's a question on reassuring allies. How does it benefit our current administration to keep our allies wondering if we'll be there when they need us? And where's
the
benefit?
I think that falls in the category of a rhetorical question. It doesn't, and we shouldn't. I think the NATO alliance is the most successful defensive alliance in history. Article 5 was, as everyone I think here knows, first invoked after 9/11, and everyone rallied to our defense. And I think it is foolhardy to endanger that. And I feel just as strongly about our Asian allies, because it's not only NATO, as I mentioned. We have Australia, Korea, Japan, and all of these countries could have nuclear weapons quite quickly if they did not feel confident in our extended deterrent.
And if I were a leader of a third world country seeking nuclear weapons, who should I approach? Is there an AQ con in the world today, who helped others?
For those who don't know, if you haven't heard of AQ con, you might have heard of Typhoid Mary. So AQ con is a Typhoid Mary of proliferation. He was a Pakistani scientist, and I like to remind people he was working for a European state-owned enterprise called Urenco, which is a company one-third British, one-third Dutch, and one-third German, which enriches uranium. They did that because they didn't want to depend on the U.S. anymore in the early 1970s. And in Almelo, in the Netherlands, this guy stole blueprints, and he became a national hero because that's where the Pakistani nuclear weapon came from. We believe that's where the North Korean design came from. We believe that they helped Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So good news, bad news. He has now shuffled off this mortal coil. So you could consider that from a proliferation standpoint, good news. The bad news is, frankly, and I said this in my remarks, nuclear weapons ain't that hard, right? I mean, the technology is old. The principal safeguard we have nowadays against nuclear weapons proliferation is working on the demand side of the equation. Don't get me wrong, I still believe in export controls, but let's face it, those can be evaded, and it's an eroding asset the more and more sophistication. And by the way, AI makes it even easier. People will remember a guy named Howard Moreland in the Wisconsin Progressive in 1978, and he went around a bunch of different documents and he took a piece of unclassified here and there and said, this is how you can make a bomb. You could probably do that in 4 seconds with ChatGPT right now, right? So let's not kid ourselves. And so the fact that there isn't a Typhoid Mary who's got the blueprints anymore, it's better than having one, but it's cold comfort given the state of the diffusion of technology writ large. Not to be cavil about it, but it's still hard to get fissile material. You still have to get fissile material. But to use a cowboy metaphor, you don't necessarily have to roll your own. So it has been remarked that we haven't talked about Saudi Arabia, that the Saudi leadership has indicated if Iran gets a bomb, they're going to get one too. Well, there's at least been speculation, you know, why make your own when you can buy one from Pakistan, right? So it's dangerous.
And with this renewed interest that you've talked about in countries having nuclear weapons, are the current treaties adequate, like the NPT, or is anyone speaking about a new treaty to calm the waters?
Who remembers Huckleberry Hound Dog, the cartoon? Remember when Huckleberry Hound Dog was in a rowboat and there was a hole in the rowboat? And he goes, I better drill another hole, let the water out. You know, and then the boat was going like this, then it goes like that. That's how I view the NPT. I mean, the NPT may have a hole or two in it, but, and I don't know what, you are very, you know, great professionals here. I think if we try to amend it, it's going to fray and fall apart because it's already under stress. And in my humble opinion, the best thing to do is to preserve what we've got and strengthen it in terms of the implementation. And some of that has to happen from outside the four corners of the treaty in terms of the conduct of countries like the United States in providing this nuclear umbrella that makes other countries feel reassured they are safer without nuclear weapons. And the other thing we need to do, in my view, is strongly support the enforcement mechanism, which is the International Atomic Energy Agency. This was conceived by Eisenhower, started in 1957. It's led now by an extraordinarily talented and dedicated individual, Rafael Grossi. He's now running vigorously to become the next Secretary General of the United Nations. I think that's a mixed bag because I think he could be very good at that job, but I think he's been very good at this job, and he can go toe-to-toe with U.S. President, with Macron, with Putin. You need somebody who's got that level of international gravitas and respect. But that person has to be empowered with sufficient authorities and funding to do the inspection job right. So he has to have not only the traditional guards, dogs, and lights, and camera seals, and so forth, but I think they need things that are embodied in what we call the additional protocol to allow not just traditional inspections of declared facilities, but allow them to have kind of a walking brief that they can pick and choose suspected sites and go inspect those as well. So I would take the existing institutions and shore them up, because I fear if you tried to sort of amend the NPT, the whole thing would unravel.
Now here's a topic that had to come up. What about Israel? Not a signature to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, widely assumed to have nuclear weapons, and has an unbalanced leadership in Netanyahu. Is that something we should worry about?
Yes. If you accept the premise of the question. No, I mean, it's a dangerous neighborhood, it's a dangerous world, and they are unbounded by treaty obligations and inspections. So it's, you know, that, you remember that there was a song about the knee bones connected to the thigh bone? Everything's connected in the Middle East, so I don't mean to be glib, but there's a lot to worry about.
And then how about Iran? We've been talking for 30 years about Iran has within 6 months of a nuclear weapon, and they don't seem to have one. Are they serious about getting nuclear weapons? And if so, why haven't they so far?
Well, I think you have to segregate history into the pre- and post-Midnight Hammer eras, right? I mean, and for what it's worth, and you can find this online, I was sent by the Obama White House to negotiate with Iran in 2009, and we actually cut a deal to get all the low-enriched uranium out in exchange for providing what's called high-assay low-enriched uranium, 19.75%, to the Tehran Research Reactor, which putatively was for medical radioisotopes. You can read the Belfer report on why it fell apart. But they elevated to an art form kind of the cat and mouse game. And there's a thing in the jargon of arms control called latency, which is to have a nuclear weapons capability, but you don't actually cross the Rubicon and test. And the theory is you can kind of get the benefit of the leverage of having people worry about you, but not absorb the penalty of crossing that line and having somebody clobber you. So when Midnight Hammer actually clobbered them, it kind of not only took out a bunch of facilities, but it took out that theory, right? Took out the theory of the case. So the thing that worries me is if there's still a handful of scientists around in Iran who are either, in their view, patriotic or crazy enough to keep working on it, and enough machines around or rebuilt that they can spool up some material. And I'm not exactly sure the exact status of the 440 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium they already had. My fear and concern is they're going to say, well, like, restraint didn't actually get us the benefit that we thought it would, and maybe they would like to take a page out of the Kim Jong-un playbook and buy themselves some immunity. They have to worry about, they are so incredibly penetrated, if they chose to try to sprint to the bomb, if they would get there before the Israelis got there first and got them. So I think that's the question.
And back to China for a moment. You talked about the increase in Chinese nuclear weapon production, and the Chinese have said forever that they're not going to negotiate on nuclear weapons until they get back to the level of the U.S. and Russia. So isn't in some way China getting more nuclear weapons part of the solution, i.e. that it might lead to discussions and further reductions, than part of the problem? It's an interesting way of thinking about it.
I mean, we'll have to see, right? Because you're right, or your question is right. That is what they say. So I think it's kind of a cold, hard fact that we're not going to have meaningful arms control until they are at what they deem to be parity. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that once that happens, they're going to, okay, let's take our 1,500 down to 300. I don't think you can take that for granted. And I think, frankly, you've got to analyze all of that also in the wider strategic context of China and its ambitions vis-a-vis Taiwan.
Interesting. So someone wants to know more of a technical question. How responsible and constrained are the command and control systems for nuclear weapons in Russia and China? Is it possible that rogue people can launch these things?
I mean, this is one of those things, there's the standard responses, I could tell you, but then I have to shoot you, right? I don't know. One hopes. I would just say this, and this is written up in my last book to some degree. You know that saying, it's better to be lucky than smart? So we all know about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but there were a number of other close calls and mistakes and warheads that wound up where they weren't supposed to be, and times in which individuals got indications of a massive launch coming their way and overrode the systems that is during President Carter would have led potentially to us launching a bunch of ICBMs to prevent a decapitation strike. So I would say if even the United States has had its problems, I think it'd be unwise to assume that China and Russia don't.
So then also, on technical, in the absence of actual testing, how do we know that nuclear weapons are A, real, or B, reliable?
It's a great question. I will give a glib and then a real answer. The glib answer is, who's going to attack us on the theory that when we shoot a nuke at them, it's not going to go off, right? I mean, you know, what is a standard here? But the second thing is this. This is really, really, really interesting. It was 1992 when the United States suspended physical testing of nuclear weapons under President George Herbert Walker Bush. We have not tested a physical weapon since that time, although it has been proposed, including by the current administration. In the early years of that, there was, and again, Karen and you were in these conversations, there was anxiety and concern among the technical community, the laboratories, Los Alamos, Livermore, Sandia, of the reliability, because we always said, and every year, the three weapons lab directors from Sandia, Livermore, and Los Alamos, and the Secretary of Energy have to report to the President that our deterrent is safe, secure, and reliable. And there was anxiety in that community. There was invented at the time, and IBM actually was involved in this, a thing called stockpile stewardship. Massive computers that simulated the conditions of a nuclear weapon. We have over 1,000 nuclear weapons tests, physical tests, lots of data from them. So now they had these incredibly powerful computer systems and massive parallel processing to analyze thousands of tests worth of data. And so you actually found over time, the scientists saying, hey, this is really good. I'm actually learning stuff from these computers I couldn't have learned from an additional physical test. And so I heard one lab director say, it used to be the program of record, the stockpile stewardship. Now it's the record of intent, because that's what they wanted to do. So I think that's still the zeitgeist in a lot of the lab community. And so I do continue, especially if we get these annual certifications. I left out the National Nuclear Security Administrator also signs these certifications to the president. That is the part of the Department of Energy that is the former Manhattan Project. I guess just a footnote here, your audience might want to know. Many, many people, including many people who were invited to be Secretary of Energy, did not know at that moment that actually the biggest job of the Department of Energy is the custodianship of our nuclear weapons arsenal. So when I was Deputy Secretary, just to give you a rough order of magnitude, the budget was maybe $26, $27 billion, of which $12 billion was taking care of the stockpile, modernizing the warheads, life extensions, and so forth. $6 billion was cleanup of all the junk that we made going all the way back to World War II and Manhattan Project. $5 billion was pure science, which also was rooted in the weapons program, including the radiological effects on human tissue, right? The Human Genome Project was funded in large part by the Department of Energy. And only $3 billion was what you think of as energy. Everything, coal, gas, renewables, grid security. So it's still the hugest part of the department. And I think that this stockpile stewardship program does, in my mind, keep our existing deterrent safe, secure, and reliable.
So we've talked about explosive nuclear weapons. You haven't talked at all about dirty bombs. Is there any control over those, or should we be worried about them?
Yeah, one thing, the first thing you have to remember about dirty bombs is it's a completely different kettle of fish. You know, when you have a fission bomb, you're taking a very large uranium isotope and splitting them and releasing neutrons that create a chain reaction, which release enormous quantum of energy according to the E equals mc squared formula of Albert Einstein. And, for example, Hiroshima was on the order of 15,000 tons of TNT, 15 kilotons. A fusion bomb is the opposite. You take the lightest possible atoms, hydrogen, and you overcome their natural repulsion, and it releases so much energy that instead of having 15 kilotons, you get megatons. And this is why you can blow up like, which you shouldn't, but Bikini Atoll, and the unbelievable destructive power of these is enormous. Now, what was the question? I forgot. I got so wrapped up in that.
The question was dirty bombs.
Oh, dirty bombs.
What would you be worried about?
Completely different kettle of fish. Dirty bomb is you take a stick of TNT and you go to a hospital and you get some medical radioisotopes and wrap it around the TNT and go boom. and it's not producing, you know, kiloton or megaton yields. But the second point is, produce a lot of fear. You probably get, you know, some fatalities of people who are close by. It's a terror weapon. Think of, like, if you did a dirty bomb at a hospital in Manhattan, and the panic of people trying to flee, you know, you could lose a lot of people just by inducing panic. And that's why people like Senator Sam Nunn have been very worried. I mean, this may not be a fair analogy, but people may not know this, but Fukushima, how many radiation deaths came out of Fukushima? Anybody want to guess? There was one recorded in 2000, I think it was 18, of a first responder who got a workman's comp claim, the survivor benefits. But the 19,000 lives tragically lost were lost from the tsunami and the earthquake. It's a millennial earthquake. I think they lost a couple thousand from evacuation of people who were in fragile medical conditions. So panic is a real weapon, right? And that's where dirty bombs come in.
Then here's more of a political question than anything. Many of our arms control agreements, I think all but this New START treatment, were pursued by and signed by Republican presidents and supported by Republican Senate. Can you speak to the current Republican views and likelihood of the U.S. pursuing negotiations to further control nuclear weapons? Is there any stomach for that left in the Republican leadership?
I was always very careful when I was in a position of answering press questions, never to speak on behalf of somebody who I wasn't, right? And so I could not speculate. I would note as a factual matter, actually, arms control has been pursued by presidents of both parties. LBJ did the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, Jimmy Carter tried to do SALT II and so forth. There is a, if you will, Nixon to China aspect in which, because Republicans have, in many opinions, more street cred when it comes to national security, they can have more effective ability to get things through the very difficult Senate ratification process. I don't know. I think actually one can say that even now there has been some indication of a willingness to engage in arms control. It was actually, as you know, Putin who stopped the verification provisions under New START. But in the absence of any willingness on the part of the Russians, or as has been mentioned earlier, the Chinese to engage, I haven't seen a willingness to engage. But I would not dismiss it out of hand. I mean, think about, for example, during the first Trump administration, he was very ambitious about doing some very significant arms control and disarmament deal with North Korea. So without trying to be a political pundit, which I am not, it's not beyond imagination that the current president would see, and he's spoken very negatively about nuclear weapons writ large and very strongly about the threat they pose to humanity. So I wouldn't put it out of the realm of conception that they might do something if they felt they had an opportunity. And he does seem to feel he's got some special connection to Vladimir Putin.
And then finally, so I think we've run out of time. You talked about lack of what we need is leadership in these areas. Is leadership something we then should be teaching, and is it something that you can teach people?
You know, this is an interesting thing. I used to think all these studies of leadership were sort of eyewash. I don't think that anymore. I mean, I think people can learn a lot of studying people like Abraham Lincoln, who famously said, "I do not claim to control events, but plainly confess to be controlled by events," and yet what an extraordinary leader. And the problem is, you can't have leadership if nobody's following you. So here's what I pray for. I pray that with the concatenation of risks that we are now facing, that people who are thoughtful and insightful and who have high ambition to political office take this into account and build it into their campaigns when they're thinking about running for high office, including the office of the President of the United States. My fear is that in the absence of somebody doing that with what I think is already a compelling case, that it's going to take something dreadful to persuade us to do something. And given the potential morphological damage and psychological damage that can be inflicted by these horrific weapons, I hope it does not come to that. But when you think just the one obvious case in point, when did we get the hotline treaty that provided for direct communication between the head of the then Soviet Union and the President of the United States? It was after the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, hopefully it's not going to take something of that dimension or even worse to persuade us to take smart action this time. And so once again, we come back to the Mid-Coast Foreign Relations Forum that you chair and conversations that you all can start.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Well,